This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. We've been keeping track of the COVID-19 pandemic as it has been occurring here in Indiana. And now we've gotten word from the Indiana Red Cross in particular of some problems that the coronavirus is having an impact on blood supply in the Hoosier State. Let's check now with the man who's in charge of the Indiana Red Cross. And Chad Priest is the regional CEO. Chad, thank you for joining us on Regionally Speaking today.
Thanks, Chris. Thanks for having me.
All right. Well, fill us in with all the bad details, and then tell us what Hoosiers can do to try to help make up on the supply, because it is behind.
Absolutely. Since the COVID-19 pandemic began, so we're going back about 28, 30 days, we've had 4,000 blood drives canceled in the United States. That's a loss of about 100,000 units of blood. Here in Indiana, that's 150 drives, nearly 5,000 units. And every day, Chris, we're getting cancellations as businesses and schools and other places canceled drives. So there is a severe shortage of our blood supply. We are really in uncharted territory with respect to our inventory level. And we're asking every American, no matter where they are, if they're healthy, to come give blood right now.
Mm-hmm. Where do most of the blood drives take place here in Indiana?
Normally, our blood drives take places in schools, both in high schools and on college campuses, but also in businesses. So as you can imagine, the early closure of schools, by the way, very appropriate to close these places. We absolutely want to promote this social distancing. But because most of our drives take place in school or corporate environments, these closures are having a severe impact on our blood supply.
Okay. From what you can tell, and maybe from anecdotal or from comments that you may have received there at the office in Indianapolis, what reasons are people mentioning that the reason they're not able to or cannot or either or won't maybe for that matter be able to donate blood?
Well, I've been really, really buoyed as we've looked across the entire state at how Hoosiers are responding. We do have some instances where blood donors are telling us, hey, I'm not comfortable coming to the blood donation center. And we've been assuring them that not only is it very safe to give blood, you cannot transmit COVID-19 through the blood supply, and we're taking extraordinary measures to make sure that our drives are safe, including screening for temperature and health at the entrance, maintaining social distancing during our drives, keeping our beds very far apart, not having lines or queues and that sort of thing. So far, when we've asked, we've seen Hoosiers step up, and I'm not surprised. That's in our DNA. Our problem has been primarily finding places for these drives, and that can be frustrating because cancellations are coming in every hour, and then we're scrambling. But people can go to redcrossblood.org, type in their zip code, no matter where they are, and find a blood drive near them. But we asked for some patience for two things. One, that list is changing all the time. And two, we're going to need our blood supply to be consistent and safe and adequate over many, many weeks. So if everyone comes out today and gives blood, we're going to find ourselves in 2 or 3 weeks in the exact same position. So spacing out how you consider your drives, that's okay. And if you're a business owner or a person that's in charge of a facility and you want to donate or the use of that facility, we want you to be in touch so that we can contact you about hosting a blood drive.
I know that the question has come up here and the encouragement from the governor all the way down the line, so to speak, is to avoid mass gatherings. Is a blood drive of any type considered a mass gathering?
The governor has made it very clear that he wants Hoosiers to donate blood and that it is not at all inconsistent with the social distancing orders that have been in place. Mm-hmm. We've tried for a long time to figure out a artificial substitute for human blood, and we just don't have one. And so we have got to get folks out to blood drives. So we do want people to stay home. Non-essential travel should be canceled. I think we need as Hoosiers to consider that going to give blood is essential, and now more than ever.
Okay. Now, I guess the question comes up, not only is it safe to give blood, but worse yet, could you contract COVID-19 from it?
Yeah, absolutely no evidence that COVID-19 or really any respiratory virus that we know of can be transmitted through the blood supply. So donation is safe, and it is safe to receive blood. An important note, we don't test our blood for COVID-19. We've seen on social media some folks saying, hey, if I go to give blood, is that a way to get a test?
Yeah.
It's important to note that that is not an appropriate way because we do not do testing.
Yeah, so there, you should, if you need a test, go get a test, but you'll get a specific test. And a lot of that I know is just basically by swabbing inside your mouth and then taking that and doing the test from that.
Yeah, we refer you completely to your doctor and to the public health authorities for that testing. because there's no way that virus can be transmitted during blood transfusion.
Now, you're spending the day today talking with reporters all across the state of Indiana to make a mention of the fact that there is a critical blood supply, actually a severe blood shortage is the way I know it's being put out. And what kind of reaction are you getting from not only from the media that you've talked to, but from other people, too, about the efforts to try to encourage more people to go out and donate blood?
Yeah, ours is a great state. We see time and time again at the Red Cross the beauty of the humanitarian response of the citizens of Indiana. It's been no different here. We're getting a great response, but keep in mind, only 3% of Americans donate blood.
Yeah.
3%. So even if all of those folks tried their best to do the right thing, we'd still be short. We need everyone who's healthy to consider donating right now.
Well, Chad, thank you very much for spending time with us. We're hoping for the best that you get more supplies in through with the blood drives and donations of any type to help meet this very severe blood shortage. And the best of luck to you and everybody, and stay safe and healthy.
Appreciate you. Stay safe as well. Thank you.
We're doing our best. Chad Priest is the regional CEO for the American Red Cross Indiana region. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte, and as we continue taking a look at the coronavirus pandemic coverage here across the Hoosier State now, let's talk with Indiana Public Broadcasting's digital editor, Lauren Chapman. And Lauren, thanks for joining us on the program.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Well, a lot of things that have been talked about here in the last 24 to 48 hours about the pandemic coverage that we've been able to bring on from IPB News on Lakeshore Public Radio. And if you will, start us out and tell us with some of the latest stories that you've had to be able to handle, you and the team in Indianapolis, concerning the pandemic itself. And I guess it almost changes almost by the hour, doesn't it?
A little bit, yeah. I've been putting out a daily kind of update of all of the coverage that we've been working on, and it feels like almost every morning I have to send out a note to make sure that we're updating web as new numbers come out. So as far as cases that have been confirmed in the state, 39 have been confirmed by the Indiana Department of Indiana State Department of Health. And that includes two deaths in Marion and Johnson counties, which are in the Indianapolis area. But for example, there's a lot of other effects that are going on, including a story from our workforce development reporter in South Bend, Justin Hicks, who put together a story about the Department of Workforce Development and kind of how Indiana's unemployment insurance program is actually set up to respond to COVID-19 and how they're asking folks to apply online, to apply early, to avoid being in person. In addition, our business reporter, Samantha Horton, who's based in Indianapolis, did a story about a distillery in Indy that is currently working on hand cleanser to send out to the most vulnerable populations. And the folks at WFIU TIU in Bloomington also have a distillery near them that's doing the same thing. So there's just a huge response from businesses, from government agencies, from a little bit of everybody trying to get a handle on how to help best protect vulnerable populations at this time.
One of the stories I noticed that's out there that we've had on is also from IPB News reporter Darian Benson about the travel screenings that seem to have created some chaos. And in particular, one Central Indiana woman who was coming through O'Hare International Airport was not happy with the way that things were handled up there.
Yeah, not at all. And in fact, in the middle of that story, she basically said, you know what, if we get sick, we didn't pick up the coronavirus internationally. We picked it up at O'Hare International.
Mm-hmm.
The federal government abruptly put updated travel screenings in place over the weekend. And so for international travelers who were coming back from places that didn't necessarily have COVID-19 quite yet or hadn't started reporting cases, that came as a surprise, not only to international travelers, but also apparently to folks in customs as well.
We're talking with IPP News reporter who covers the digital beat, Lauren Chapman, about the stories that are out there concerning COVID-19 and coronavirus. One other story I know, too, is a story that maybe concerns women in particular, of course, is how the COVID-19 high-risk groups ought to include pregnant women.
Yeah, as this has gone on, the health officials and the recommendations, not only from our country, but from international organizations like the World Health Organization, have continued to try and update guidelines for who needs to social distance and who needs to be particularly careful when interacting with folks. And we received a bunch of questions from our texting tool and from our embedded questions within our digital stories, specifically about pregnant women. And so we reached out, Darian Benson, our health reporter, reached out to an Indianapolis OBGYN. And basically she explained, you know, based on guidance from similar viruses like MERS and SARS and the flu, women who have just given birth or women who are currently pregnant are considered high risk, part of that high risk population. So it's anyone with a compromised immune system. It's anyone over the age of 60. It's anyone with heart disease or lung disease, potentially even asthma or any other lung related conditions. This is the thing that we've heard from doctors over and over again, is that the problem is that we don't have a treatment for this virus. So if you get sick and your body responds to it in a certain way, there's no way to treat the underlying condition. They can only treat the symptoms.
Mm-hmm. One of the stories that has been posted out there as well, too, concerns the coronavirus and how long it can live on surfaces. And I guess one story that's out there talks about maybe living for as many as 2 or 3 days. Well, how do you clean the germs away when you have a long-lasting issue out there like that?
Thankfully, I am a little bit of a germaphobe, or at least I was raised by proud germaphobes. And so I went digging myself a little bit to figure out what is supposed to be cleaning this. So one of the things that had been circulating around online was that you could use Tito's vodka in order to clean surfaces. The problem is that the proof system for alcohol is not percent. It is a different measurement. So what folks need to be looking for is either 60% alcohol for hand sanitizers, using bleach, using most of your standard cleaning products will do the job as long as it's not fluffier. So your Bath and Body Works, maybe half a glitter hand sanitizer might not be doing the trick. But for surfaces, bleach-based products, alcohol-based products, that's what you're going to really be looking for, because the goal is to break down basically the fatty shell of a virus. Soap and water does the most to help that out.
The stories that are posted with IPP News also about hand sanitizers, talking about how Indiana company that I guess really puts out another product has been able to offer a hand sanitizer that is going to help low-risk people as well.
Hotel Tango in Indianapolis and another distillery in Bloomington have both turned their focus in a bar they've mostly been shut down, has turned their focus to helping create hand cleanser. So one of the CEO of Hotel Tango mentioned that he had seen that same guidance of like, oh, you know, you can use, if it's this percent of alcohol, then this will actually work for hand sanitizer. Knowing the business, knowing the science and the chemistry of it, being somebody who works in distilling, said, hey, you know what? This is an opportunity to help folks. And so at least at Hotel Tango, they've already gone into production, and they're focusing specifically on getting hand cleanser to vulnerable populations, so things like homeless shelters, other organizations, to try and get that out to folks as soon as possible.
It just looks like in general that with the advice that we can give out there that you folks with the IPP News have covered with the stories that we put out online as well as on the air, it's just a matter, I guess, of knowing, as you mentioned, the sanitizers will help keep things clean, and just keeping yourself clean in general. Some of the common sense points that are out there, can you bring some of those to light to us that you've mentioned?
Samantha Horton did a story about basically economists are saying, hey, don't freak out about this. Don't go hoarding because the supply chain is going to just continue to be stressed by you doing that. So the Indiana governor and federal regulations and executive orders have opened up lines for truckers to be able to better provide supplies, prioritizing food and medicine throughout the state. So we're, you know, the lines are being opened in order to get folks food and medicine and necessities. So just don't freak out at the grocery store as well.
Lauren Chapman, thank you very much for spending time going over the stories that IPB News has offered up out there. We've been able to bring online as well as on the air here at Lakeshore Public Radio. And we'll keep our eyes peeled, so to speak, and be prepared for whatever new information and developments break in the coronavirus pandemic now. Thank you for spending time to go over some of those with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Lauren Chapman is the digital editor for IPB News based out of Indianapolis. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte, and continuing on with some of the news involving Northwest Indiana and the COVID-19 epidemic, pandemic, I guess we should say. Joe Pete with the Times of Northwest Indiana has been covering a number of stories business-related that we'll bring up now. And Joe, thanks for joining us on the program today.
Oh, glad to be here, Chris. Just wish it were under a more normal circumstance.
I know. That's what we all think the same way, too. And people that are everybody's involved in one way or the other in some type of business, it seems. We know, and in fact, we'll cover a lot of these here in our conversation today. But let's start out first talking about the banking industry. The friendly teller that you would normally go in to see to take care of an account or to cash a check or to take care of other business is not there today because there are a number of banks here in Northwest Indiana that have decided to close up the lobbies. Tell us all about that.
Oh, absolutely. Most of the banks based in Northwest Indiana announced yesterday that they're going to be closing all of their lobbies. Some are still open by appointment only, but they're encouraging Centier, Maryville-based Centier, Munster-based People's Bank, the First State Bank of Porter, and American Community Bank in Munster. They have all announced that in an effort to reduce the spread of COVID-19 and to put public safety first in this time of crisis, that they are going to close all their lobbies. People can still call and make an appointment if they need to do something like access a, or if they need to do some kind of paperwork that they can only do in the branch or start a loan or something of that. But they're pretty much banning all walk-in traffic. They're encouraging people to bank online, to bank on their phone, to bank via the ATM. All the branches are still open during regular hours, but they're open by drive-up only. And in one case, American Community Bank, they're encouraging people, if they don't have a car, they're saying it's okay to go up to the drive-up and be on foot or be on your bike. Just please watch for traffic around you. Today, Horizon Bank followed suit. It's the third largest bank in Northwest Indiana by market share, and it announced it's closing or it's restricting all of its lobbies to appointment only. Mm-hmm. You've seen there's a lot of trend. A lot of the national banks that serve the area, too, some of the bigger regional ones out of Chicago. I don't know about, you know, call your specific branch ahead of time because this is a very fluid and rapidly developing situation. But Wintrust, First Midwest, and some of the others were closing some branches or consolidating branches temporarily, you know, just through the duration of this to walk in traffic while... and also the in-store branches at most banks are being closed in supermarkets, such as the Centier ones in Strachan Mantua locations, because there's obviously no way to do like drive up or, you know, inside another store. But the most of the banks are just closing to walk in traffic for the time being. They're monitoring the situations and they plan to, you know, reopen as soon as public health authorities say it's safe to do so.
So obviously, with banks like, we'll say, for example, with the Centier banks that you mentioned in the Strachan Vantil stores, the inside tellers obviously are not working, but I guess the bank machines are still working. You can do whatever you can do, at least on an ATM, right?
Oh, absolutely. And then some of the larger banks like Chase and PNC are encouraging people to do most of their banking by mobile. They're not, as of the last I checked, they hadn't yet started to close the branch, the bank interiors, but they were encouraging people to do as much of their banking online as possible. And these banks are fully staffed. Horizon stressed today that this bank's, all the departments are fully staffed. You can call and bank by telephone with any of its departments. And then if you needed to go in to access like a safe deposit box or, you know, to fill out like a loan application or something like that. You can do that by appointment, but you can't just saunter in off the street, grab some coffee, and they're just encouraging you. Most of these banks have seen a decline over the years anyway in foot traffic at the branches. A lot of the younger consumers especially are using mobile and online. You could do most of your routine banking through that, and if you absolutely need to for any reason, you still can make an appointment to visit your local bank branch. Just give them a call. People are still working. They're not closed. Closed.
They're still very busy inside, and probably even busier, especially if you have drive-through business. They still have to have the tellers on hand for that, to be sure. So let's cover now, pardon me, some of the cover some of the other issues involving coronavirus that you've had out in print and online here. The latest as far as virus reports, or I should say confirmed reports, rather, of the virus includes some folks who work at the Lear Corporation factory in Hammond.
Oh, absolutely. It was Wednesday. The workers were told just before lunch that a supervisor had tested positive for coronavirus. The company later said that they've had a supervisor had tested positive, and they had another person on the same shift, an assembly line worker, who was a presumed positive for coronavirus. And initially they were still working there, but there was a kind of an outcry from workers that didn't feel that it was safe. People made the point, like, you know, if you're there, they make seats that go into the Ford Explorers and other vehicles. They make it Ford's Chicago assembly plant just across the state line in Hagwish. They were making the point that if one sick person touches a seat, it goes down the assembly line and like 5,500 people are touching that same seat. So it's very easy in that kind of industrial environment for the coronavirus to potentially spread, and they were concerned about the availability of disinfectants and hand sanitizers. But a couple hours after the company announced that it was, and the union local 2335 was very active in asking for like a shutdown and to follow some of the guidelines laid out by the CDC. But a couple hours after that, Lear did announce it would be shutting down the plant for a deep cleaning. Initially, it was only supposed to be overnight, but apparently that got extended. This whole situation is fluid and changing every couple of minutes.
Yeah.
But then it got extended to Thursday. But then the UAW, it resulted in a shutdown of the Chicago assembly plant because they make the seats. It's a just-in-time operation there.
Well, that's why I was wondering, It's because it's dependent waiting for those trucks to come over from, for example, for the seats from the Lear plant to come over and slip them right onto the line,
Oh, absolutely! Especially with the auto industry, it has a very it's all very interconnected, and all the suppliers. There's a network. Like one disruption can disrupt an entire web of employers across the Calumet region, both on the Illinois side, but plenty on the Indiana side as well. But the Chicago assembly plant had to shut down because it didn't have parts. Because basically, as soon as the seats are trucked over from Hammond and are unloaded, they're pretty much in a vehicle, and I've seen it, it's pretty efficient. They're in a vehicle in the next half hour or so over in Chicago, and they had to shut down because of that. But then the UAW managed to negotiate. They had said from the start, the United Auto Workers Union, they had hoped for a shutdown to sanitize and disinfect these plants. They had formed a task force with the big three automakers, and they were looking at things to do because they're also concerned the industrial environments are potentially very prone to spread contagion with the automotive industry, because you have you not only have like assembly lines where people are touching the same parts and vehicles, so one infected person could potentially infect many down the line. You also have shift changes where everybody starts the shift at 6 or ends the shift at 6, and then you have huge masses of workers all gathered at the entrances and exits at the same time, trying to get in or out of the plant because, it's several hundred or 1,000 people are working all at the same time. So they've been trying to study ways that they can encourage more social distancing and other best practices, staying like 6 feet away from people so as not to spread this disease. Because even if you are infected by it and survive it, if you're young, you're healthy, you might survive it, but you could still pass it on to others and kill others, especially those in more vulnerable groups like older and immunocompromised. So the big steps all these companies are taking is intended to stop the spread of it, to protect their employees, their customers, and just stop the spread of it. But the UAW managed to talk the big three automakers into shutting down all their U.S. Initially, it was going to be a rotating shutdown of plants to do deep cleaning, but it turned into a total shutdown through March 30th. And they're going to be doing deep cleans of Chicago Assembly in Haguish and of Chicago Stamping in Chicago Heights, as well as plants across the country. Honda also announced that it was going to close its U.S. plants for 6 days and clean out those. That seems to be a big trend right now with a lot of companies, not just in automotive and manufacturing, but a lot of different sectors at this point.
Well, at this point, too, you have movie theaters now. They're going through the deep cleaning process as well, too, because they're all closed up, the ones that we normally go to here in Northwest Indiana.
Oh, absolutely, yes. Basically, the movie theater companies say their hands were forced by the federal government was saying, giving out the guideline, no more than 10 people should really gather. AMC, probably the largest chain, they have local theaters in Cherryville. The old Showplace 16 and Showplace 12 at an AMC Classic in Hobart by the South Lake Mall and another one in Michigan City. They were saying it pretty much makes it impossible for them to gather if no more, or impossible for them to operate as a movie theater if no more than 10 people could gather at the same time. In addition, across the nation, you've actually had bans on gatherings. In, like in Indiana, there's a ban on gatherings of 250 people or more, and it's even more restrictive in many places. Including most of their major markets. So they were forced to shut down temporarily nationwide. And the Portage IMAX and Cinemark and Valparaiso and basically all the major operators followed suit because, it's unlikely it would even be profitable for them if they had fewer than 10 customers in a theater anyway. But they have all closed for the time being. Hollywood is delayed. Even if they had remained open, Hollywood has delayed most of its major releases, including, Fast and the Furious, James Bond, Black Widow, a lot of the big blockbuster movies that were supposed to come out this year have been delayed because they were concerned about people not coming out to the theaters. And, they invest, millions of dollars in these bigger movies and millions of dollars in the marketing, and they don't want to, waste it by having, showing it to half-empty theaters where people are, hunkering down at home to stay safe and to avoid the transmission of this contagious and sometimes deadly disease. Mm-hmm.
Let's talk for a minute here, Joe, about South Lake Mall. There have been some changes that have been made there, and you had one of that in one of your stories in the Times this week and online as well, too. Tell us where we stand as far as the mall is concerned and the stores inside the mall.
Yes, we've gotten some questions, too, about why is the mall staying open and supermarkets staying open when these public gatherings are banned. I've seen some... From some public health authorities suggest it's safer if there's motion, if airports and supermarkets and so forth, if people are moving around instead of staying stagnant or instead of milling around and just being in close proximity to each other where they can sneeze and cough on each other and so forth, that there's a greater element of, it lessens the risk somewhat. But you have seen some, I've seen a couple malls in the country close. What South Lake Mall has done now is reduced its hours. It has Macy's has closed its stores nationwide, so one of its biggest anchors is now closed for the time being. But it's put in a number of steps. They're disinfecting. They're cleaning and disinfecting everything regularly. They put in hand sanitizer stations. That's one permanent change you might see from this. Businesses across Northwest Indiana are now installing hand sanitizer stations, which might become kind of a permanent fixture of daily life when you're out in public. Mm-hmm. They've discouraged employees from shaking hands, telling them to go home sick right away if they show any symptoms, any respiratory distress or coughing or anything of that nature. And they've removed a lot of the chairs from the common areas or separated others to discourage people from being in close proximity. So they're taking all kinds of safety measures to prevent to help prevent the spread of this disease.
Okay. I know one of the other stories that you had, Joe, that's in print and online, dealing with the COVID-19 pandemic involves restaurants. We know pretty well what the national chains are doing, like McDonald's and Chick-fil-A and the like. They're able to handle carry-out or drive-through a lot easier. How about our local businesses that really aren't all equipped to be able to make that sudden switch like that?
Well, many are, for the fast food chains, it's not really a big jump for them to just operate drive-through only, which some of them started to do before the bans even went into place.
Yeah.
But a lot of the local businesses have been operating on a drive-through and carry-out basis. Some of them have launched delivery for the first time. Many of them are rolling out curbside pickup, where you can call ahead or order online. You drive up, and then you don't even have to get out of your car. You've already paid in advance, and it's just dropped off with you to minimize the amount of contact. You come in with other people. A lot of the delivery ones that are popular locally, like DoorDash and Uber Eats, they now have options where it can be, the food you order from a restaurant can be left on your doorstep, and you don't have to interact with the delivery driver at all to minimize, contact and risk of spreading the disease or coronavirus. And, it's obviously been an adjustment. A lot of them are seeing businesses drop off tremendously, but they still have staff, and they still have overhead, and they have all these expenses, and they're just hoping many of them are hoping for the community support to help them through this, and hoping people are still going to, order food and either pick it up or get it delivered. It's obviously a very difficult time. Dine-in accounts for this lifeblood of, for most of the industry. And then, people too, the concern that even if people are ordering, they're going to order stuff like, that they normally order, like pizza or Chinese, but pretty much there probably are some closed restaurants, but a lot of restaurants, they don't have the luxury of being able to afford to, just shut down for a couple weeks or months. They're still operating. They're still preparing meals. It's just, you have to get it through carryout or delivery. And you've seen some restaurants have even stepped up in Crown Point, Jill Sosimo's Pizza. They're distributing like free sacked lunches to school kids who are, out of school right now to kind of help out. So a lot of these companies, they've been long part of the community. They're local independent businesses. They're the kind of businesses that support like your Little League, team. They'll let you put up a flyer for your concert or whatever. They are, they're really asking for the community's help in this time.
Well, Joe, thank you very much for the updates. We really appreciate it. Looking forward to more because they're going to be coming down the line, and especially the changes in the businesses. And just what came to mind as you were mentioning about in your last comments there about the changeover from sit-down dining to carry-out and to drive-through. We know that the Steak and Shake chain has been having a lot of problems. You don't even have to go back into that again. It's all over that. But I know that the company is looking at trying to find a way to minimize the size of their stores and their business in general by shifting away from sit-down dining in some of the Steak and Shake restaurants. And so this may be a boon, I suppose, over the way in the months ahead if they have to go completely to carry out or to drive through or whatever it may be that they haven't already been doing. So just a thought that came to mind. So it's something we can all keep an eye on as well, too, to see how these businesses survive in the months ahead here. Joe, thank you very much for being with us to talk about it today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Joe Pizza, the business reporter for the Times of Northwest Indiana. You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. And continuing on a program today, and this way shifting away from COVID-19, let's talk about the Gary Community School Corporation, which I guess in a way is related because we know that they've been trying to do their best to educate youngsters by way of their YouTube channel and all. The emergency manager had an opportunity to bring her young sons on YouTube the other day for a chance to read a book. But Carol Carlson has been keeping an eye on the more serious issues involving the Gary Community Schools, and she is with us now to bring us up today. Carol, thanks for joining us on the program today.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for having me.
Well, you're welcome. We know that the major changes that have happened, of course, is the Gary Community Schools is doing their best to try to dig themselves out of debt. And you had a chance to monitor some of the latest information on that. Bring us up to date with how the emergency management team is doing in trying to cut back on some of the expenses and in turn free up more money for repairs and to get rid of some of the buildings that they don't need.
Well, they're making strides in cutting their operating deficit. It is down to $6 million. That's from some $22 million about just 3 years ago. So that debt is coming down. And now the next step, or as part of that debt reduction, is putting all of their properties abandoned or closed, schools and just vacant land parcels, up for sale. And they did that recently, and they announced a few weeks ago that they did have offers on all 24 of those properties.
Well, it's good to know that it's good to know that they've been able to help cut back on the deficit. That's been some of the biggest problems I know they've run into, and they've had to have help from the state government on this in particular. When they're able to free up this fund, these funds, I should say, to take care of these matters in particular, what has the emergency management team been able to tell the government, in particular the Distressed Unit Appeals Board, when they talked about this last, as to where they want to be able to best invest the money that they can save?
Well, they haven't said much about that at this time. Uh-huh. In a corresponding or parallel move, though, the General Assembly has approved a bill that I don't think the governor has signed yet. I'll double-check on that today. But that bill would allow for the deferring of $20 million in state loans, so the school district could use that money in a special fund and use that money to make repairs for schools that need them, which are virtually almost all of their schools, and or they could choose to demolish a school.
What have some of our lawmakers had to say about not only about this measure, but also, too, what the Gary Community Schools in general has been doing here lately? I know there's been a lot of discussion here, probably more amongst the Northwest Indiana delegation than anybody else about this, right?
Yeah, they have been, taking the bull by the horns, you might say, ever since the Mayor Prince announced building code violations on 9 of the schools.
Mm-hmm.
And back in November, of course, the tragedy of the Portage woman found slain and was killed in Portage, but her body was dumped in a vacant Gary school. So there's a definite sense of urgency in the city and in the school district to deal with these schools, and that's permeated into the state legislature,
yeah,
too. Everybody would like to see a solution so you don't have these blighted properties all over the city.
I know that's been the major concern, and it's been not only the mayor's concerned about that, but, of course, the emergency management team is concerned about that. And they, of course, have been moving along systematically in trying to deal with the vacant schools and the other properties that the Gary Community School still has on the books out there. And they had a recent opportunity for people to put their bids in for a lot of the buildings that the Gary Community School Corporation's making available, and you had a chance to do another story about that. Bring us up to date on how the bidding has gone and the procedure that's underway right now, and about in particular some of the big players in this whole process.
Yeah, surprisingly, they did get a bid of $1.8 million for the Wirt Emerson School that's in the Miller area. And that was coming from a man named George Howard. He is from Gary, and he is a part-time pastor himself, but he runs a financial corporation, and he plans to rehab that building and turn it into like a sort of a small business incubator to provide services and a step up for small businesses to get their dreams going, I guess is the best way to say it.
So it would still be a school. It'd be a school of some type, anyway, or at least an educational facility of some type, I suppose.
Right, and if that all pans out, that would certainly be a good chunk of money going back to the Gary schools. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure if this time frame has been disrupted now by COVID-19 or not. I expect it might be. They did have a deadline set for earnest money and closing, and all of that is contingent on these folks who made their bids securing money to purchase the properties. And I don't know if that whole process has been upended or not.
I know that you mentioned besides the GM Howard Financial, the company, I guess the individual and company that is offering up an offer for the Ward Emerson building, that they've offered up, I guess, for some other properties too. And there are a number of others that have found some interest, I guess, in one in particular case, Gary developer Calvin Bankhead. He's got apparently a very ambitious plan going to want to take on so many properties.
Yeah, I believe Calvin is a retired Gary firefighter, and he has made offers on 23 properties. Now, he is a developer, so he just says in his bid that he wants them to be residences once again. So that would be a nice development. He is a high bidder on 9 of the properties. So he secures financing. That would be a nice look for those vacant properties.
And I guess we will have some properties that will definitely be end up for demolition because probably just some are just too far gone to be able to fix them up economically. So I'm sure that some of these, I'm sure the city of Gary is even interested and involved in this too.
Yeah, the city of Gary made, I think, 4 or 5 bids. And on all of their bids, they just bid $1, but they did pledge to demolish those schools.
Mm-hmm. Well, it sounds like that if we're not too delayed because of the COVID-19 pandemic and trying to get some of the economic paperwork done, like you say, and especially with banks having to cut back on their hours because of the situation, although they can still make arrangements, I guess, for loans and the like, they'll just have to take a little longer to get all the paperwork done, to be sure. So I guess we'll have to find out if some of these some of these plans actually get taken place here. But I'm sure that the Mayor Prince and other members of the administration are pleased to hear this much news on this so far, knowing that there's going to be some improvement ahead.
Yeah, I'm sure they are, too. The mayor has, of course, been occupied with other more serious matters at this point. But I'm sure that they were glad to hear that news. And I'm going to ask today if the timetable has been changed on the sale of the school.
Okay, well, there'll be another story coming up soon in the Post-Tribune. We'll look forward to seeing that, too. So, well, Carol, thank you very much for spending time going over
these two
major stories. Well, especially on these two major stories that we have to deal with the Gary Community Schools. Things are changing outside of the school district, and with the youngsters not in school, it doesn't necessarily mean that the administrators aren't busy doing other things, and this is one of the areas that they've been working at, and we'll look forward to more stories in the future from you. Thank you very much, Carol.
Thank you so much.
Carol Carlson's a reporter for the Post-Tribune, and you're listening to Regionally Speaking here on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM. Ball State University economist Michael Hicks did some research lately into what kind of impact the pandemics may have on our economy. The last conversation we had here was just earlier in this past week. And in fact, he's even had a chance to put something out on Howie Politics Indiana in the online publication, and he spoke with us about that column that he put out and about the impact that the recent coronavirus crisis seems to be having on the nation's economy and economy of Indiana for now.
The breakout in Wuhan, China, Wuhan province, is now about 8 weeks old, and a little bit over 8 weeks old. And over that time period, factory production has plummeted because the Chinese government has closed factories and restaurants and, you know, everything but just a few essential stores. And so that supply disruption in production, which feeds our factories here with component parts for auto assembly, transportation equipment, consumer electronics, is reaching our shore sort of in March and early April. And so I think we're in a supply chain, we're about to see supply chain disruptions that will cause U.S. factories to stop or at least curb most of their production for a few weeks until those factories are back up and running.
I know that we have kept an eye on all of these illnesses that have happened, the pandemics that actually have taken place, and we're going back, I guess, even before the polio scare back in the 1950s, back to the real serious large-scale viral pandemic that happened back in the 1918 with the flu. Are we finding, though, that we have the same kind of economic impact, or have things changed that much because our economy has changed that much over the decades that it's not quite the same?
Well, that's an interesting question. Some of the best work that has been done in this really looks at what happened in 1918 with the then Spanish flu.
Yeah.
And what we saw there was different from what we expect here. The death rate was much higher. It struck young people, sort of 18 to 40, very harshly. And so the loss of life had a much longer effect than a disease, for example, that would you know, affect primarily older people. And the other problem that was very consistent across the disease was the length of recovery time. So people were sick for several weeks. My grandmother was bedridden for about 3 weeks or a month as a teenager in the fall of 1918, and so I think that was fairly common. Those have economic effects, but we're not anywhere near seeing those yet. I mean, the real economic effects that we're seeing now are the supply chain effects, which are about to hit, and then the cancellation or the loss of the demand side effect involved with not going to restaurants, not going to movies, not going on that cruise or taking that vacation. I think that's what we're about to experience. And I think the stock market is reacting to the confidence, the belief that that is going to be fairly significant and it's going to disrupt the U.S. and world economy significantly, with or without sort of any long-term effect of death and morbidity associated with the disease. So the actual effects of the disease haven't hit yet. What we're experiencing is our efforts to avoid catching the disease or having it turn into, a full-fledged 80% of us sick in the same year, which would be virtually impossible for our healthcare system to adjust to.
Yeah, I'm sure mostly concerned about that, and we're talking now, too. I know if with businesses and schools trying to prepare for any other problems that come about by making sure that, number one, that employees don't get sick, and number two, that they're able to do what they can, at least to continue working by, for example, being able to work from home. But those are all some of the shutdowns, I guess, are the issues that you work on a short-term basis, aren't they?
Right, and I think it's important just to remind people we're probably not going to have food supply interruptions. We're probably not going to have real interruptions of manufactured goods, with the exception of sort of automobiles and consumer electronics for a few weeks. And the reason is those factories, A, employ very few people. They're already clean factories. You could just Google American, factory for food production. Everybody already wears masks and clean suits and the like. So that is going to continue. We're going to continue to see logistics get food to the grocery stores. Sure, if everybody buys hand sanitizer in one day, we'll be out for a few days, but there'll be a glut of hand sanitizer around in 3 weeks. So those aren't the problem. The real economic consequence is going to manifest itself in, pressures on restaurants and small businesses, the difficulty for families who maybe are stuck at home with kids for a couple, 3 weeks as schools closed. The first school in Indiana closed today, and there's going to be a lot more in the coming weeks, I suspect.
Mm-hmm. Are we seeing any long-term economic effects yet, or is that going to be the next thing we have to watch for?
Yeah, I think that's what we have to watch for. The academic work that I've seen that looked back at the 1918-1919 flu, actually found very modest long-term effects, and it's not really worth, sort of talking about the value of life estimates here. Those are personal tragedies if someone you care about is ill or someone that you love dies. But the economic consequences of a disease that affects like 80% of the population, about 5% very, very tough symptoms, is going to be not something that lasts for a long time. And I would also suggest that the the fundamentals of the economy aren't broken in the sense that while the stock market's way down, banks are solvent, there's no toxic assets out there, there's no underlying economic problem that would cause people to avoid investing. And so I think in that regard, despite the very rapid decline in the stock market, that there's no fundamental problem that's going to hang with us for 2 or 3 or 5 years like we saw after 2008.
That's Ball State University economist Michael Hicks. Offers our conversation from earlier. Of course, things are changing every single day, it seems, or every single minute in some cases. But he had some good comments that he put forth in his column that was in Howie Politics Indiana about the economic impact of the coronavirus pandemic and all. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Just to let you know that we will be bringing you updates, of course, on the COVID-19 pandemic across Northwest Indiana impact, as well as the best of Regionally Speaking starting in Monday. We hope you'll join us for that. And our thanks to Chad Priest, who's the CEO of the American Red Cross Indiana Region, to Indiana Public Broadcasting digital producer Lauren Chapman, to the Times of Northwest Indiana's Joseph Pete for the latest impact on the business scene from COVID-19, and on the new on the Gary Community School Corporation, to the Post Tribune's Carol Carlson about that. And I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you for joining us, and we'll be back with you on Monday.